You're listening to Wake Up Tucson. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Good morning to Joanne DiFilippo. How are you doing, young lady?
Great. Good morning. How are you?
Now, you started working in Pima County when?
So I actually retired from Pima County last May 2021, and I was there for 8.8 years. The reason why I know that is because I retired. And the reason why I know...
Now, did you really retire? Or you didn't have any other weird...
Well, let me tell you something.
It's Pima County. It's a whole new world on retirement.
I have gone to the Arizona State Retirement because I'd like something in writing from them about whether or not you can actually retire and collect benefits without actually terminating the employment.
Interesting.
Because everyone that I know who has retired, even if you do a return to work, like a lot of people, they might retire on a Friday and return to work on a Monday under a different type of employment.
Right.
The that allows you.
The idea that something was possibly done, well, was done concurrently,
well,
seems to be a little gray area.
I believe... Let me just say, I think that some of the supervisors were quite surprised that they didn't know that their county administrator had actually retired, or let's say he changed his employment status 9 months previous.
So I guess the question I have for you is
which that, none of us knew.
So there's a possible, one of your concerns, and we'll get to a lot of stuff here today with Joanne, but one of your concerns about the Huck's retirement is the idea that this concurrently collecting his from his Arizona retirement plan and working for the county may not jibe with what you're supposed to do with the Arizona retirement system. Is that a concern?
No.
Okay.
What can happen, and whether it's Chuck or somebody else, okay?
Right.
You can retire, like I said, let's say on a Friday. And as long as you follow all of the guidelines and requirements of ASRS, and there are a number of them, you could return to work on Monday, and then you're allowed for the next year to work a maximum of 19 weeks at full time and 33 weeks at 19 hours or less. Once that time passes, then you can work again at and any hours you want. But it's that first year following retirement that's the key.
Interesting.
Yes. That's why you will hear them say, well, he worked full-time from, I believe, what, July 5th? I think he retired on July 4th.
Yes.
So from July 5th to about November 15th, he worked full-time. Then from November 15th until, I believe, the time of in the boardroom on April the 5th when they terminated everything, that would have been 19 hours or less per week. The thing that would be interesting to see is, and I go by what I read in the newspaper, actually was in the, I believe the Sentinel, about the fact of one of the attorneys saying, well, it's not really the pay and the hours. So I don't know. There's something to maybe look at there.
We're talking about the bizarre exit of Mr. Huckleberry, but also his bizarre retirement scenario that occurred on July 4th, celebrating our nation's independence. How could he do it? The county's closed on that day. I don't know how he did that either. So
it's interesting.
So I was watching the Steve Christie questioning of Jan Lesher about this whole thing a couple of meetings ago. And so I just want to make sure you heard what I heard, and you can just tell me if I'm wrong, which is fine. So what Steve says is like, hey, to Jan, when did you know, right? What, you know, that you knew this happened, right? And then also the process of it. So what it sounded like to me is Huck started the ball rolling on the collecting retirement but working full-time at the county. And then when it sounded like who approved this, I believe Jan was like, I think she said Monica Perez. But isn't Monica Perez Chuck's assistant?
At the time, I believe Monica Perez was the executive assistant. Might be chief executive assistant,
right,
to Chuck Huckleberry.
So she's not Chuck's boss. Is all I'm. No. Yeah,
she the board works, of supervisors she, is Chuck's boss.
Right, she works for Chuck.
Yes.
Okay. Now, did I hear that wrong when Jan said, like, it was kind of the situation was approved by Monica Perez?
I think if you go back to the memo that Jan released
right.
on April the 15th.
Yes.
I didn't hear that in the boardroom.
All right, meeting. That's why okay. you're here to help me out.
But on April the 15th, if you go back and read that memo that Jan released, and it is on the county administrator's website, anybody can pull it down.
Yeah.
You'll see that Jan said that Mr. Huckleberry asked Monica Perez to coordinate.
Ah, coordinate.
Coordinate.
Okay.
And that these individuals were to closely hold this information. You can find the exact wording in the April 15th memo. But that didn't come out until April 15th, long after all of this had transpired.
Right. So then what did Monica Perez coordinate would be my question.
Well, I can only go by what the data documents that were released on right. April 20th, and there were two data dumps.
It was like hundreds of pages. Well,
the first one was 33 pages, and the second one was 199 pages. A lot of it is duplicative.
Right.
But if you take a look and go through it, it's obvious that if Chuck had instructed Monica, his assistant, to start the process, in those data dumps, you can see correspondence via email going on between HR representatives, county admin, and keep in mind, county admin consists also of other departments. So,
sure.
for example, communications reports into county admin, grants management reports into county admin, county admin reports into county admin.
So while you were talking, I was looking up that memo.
Yes.
I can't believe I found that as fast as I did. All right. So here's the exact quote from the Jan Lesher memo. Mr. Huckleberry instructed his chief executive assistant, Monica Perez, who is now my chief of staff, to work with finance and risk management and human resources to ensure compliance with ASRS,
yes.
which is the Arizona Retirement System. He instructed a limited number of staff to closely hold this information, period. Ms. Perez did as she was instructed, as did the staff in finance, risk management, and human resources. So literally, Chuck Huckleberry told Monica Perez and various folks to keep their mouth shut to the rest of the county that he was doing this.
And I think
that's what I read right here.
I think in that memo also is a statement that she just did what Chuck told her to do.
Well, I just said Ms. Perez did as she was instructed.
Yes. So
now you and I know this because we've been, well, you've worked at the county, but I've been watching this crap hole for a long time. Is Chuck intimidates everybody, right? He is the emperor from Star Wars.
I plead the fifth.
But so when I see this, right, that one, he told them to keep their mouths shut on this and literally do this deal on the QT
and go contrary to their normal procedure.
That's true.
Well, you know, and you'll hear these discussions, well, was he required to tell the Board of Supervisors? As a matter of fact, I've had some business owners state, well, we all knew that Chuck was going to retire within the past year, so what's the big deal about this? And the rhetoric that I say to them is, how would you like it if you owned a business and your general manager actually quit, retired, but didn't tell you?
Right.
You'd be a little upset about it.
But didn't the Board of Supes, the four of them who voted yes on his contract, basically either didn't read it or agreed with this dealio in the first place?
You know, I question
right?
whether or not they really knew what they were looking at.
That's what I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I don't think they read it.
Yeah.
So this is Joanne has an email. Was this from the data dump? Or,
yes.
Okay. So from the Jan Lesher data dump, there is an email from the HR director, Kathy Bolin, to David Igueta, who's chief of staff for Matt Hines. And it said, here's the gold world. Here it is. This is amazing. Hi, David. This is from April 6th. So literally a month ago.
The day after the board terminated both contracts.
That's true.
Yeah.
Right. So here we go. Human resources has no paperwork regarding the pending change in status from Mr. Huckleberry from employee to contractor on July 4th. So even Huckleberry, according to Kathy Bolin, they did not give any of this paperwork change to the human resources department. Gold, Jerry, gold. Umpire John just told us that.
I would ask the supervisors, what is so miraculous about these 11 individuals who are salaried, unclassified, nine of them earning over $100,000 a year?
Explain the unclassified thing to people.
It's usually a category that's designed for upper management, director, supervisor level, that and up. Okay?
All right. So what we have is there's this corona money that's coming down from the feds.
Yes.
That was supposed to go to employees of the county that were working with, quote, vulnerable populations.
If you look at the federal guidelines, and you can go onto the U.S. Treasury website and take a look at what were the requirements back then for the COVID money. And if you take a look at, you can do a search, let's say, on COVID incentive pay, bonuses, whatever. And there's an explanation in there that if you're giving premium pay, which is allowed, then the basis for it should be that those individuals are working with, encountering, servicing vulnerable populations, which then might make those employees subject to being vulnerable themselves or having to put in extra time. To have someone, let's say, from the sheriff's department or the health department get premium pay is probably very explainable. Okay? It's when you start taking it outside that realm that you have to look at and say, what is the basis for this premium pay? Now, as we know, based on my public records request, I asked what the criteria was. And the response that I got back from the county is, no responsive documents found. And then I asked, who approved the bonuses? And this is all in a public records request. And they said Chuck Huckleberry did. So I was like, okay, this is getting murkier.
Now, one of the questions I have for you is, in addition to these 11 unclassified employees who got these bonuses, did anyone else in the county get these bonuses?
I believe there were probably individuals, let's say, from sheriff's, health department, et cetera.
So your question here is, why did these 11 get bonuses?
And I was particularly concerned about this because I knew individuals in the county, let's say, for example, the individuals who work in Parks and Recs, of which an overwhelming number of them are quote-unquote people of color, okay, making probably $35,000, $40,000, $45,000 a year. And there are the park technicians.
Yep.
They have to go in, and these people were regarded as essential employees during the pandemic, meaning they had to show up for work.
Yeah, they couldn't stay at their house.
Yeah, they couldn't telecommute or work remotely unless they moved the park over to their house, okay? So they were required to come to work, and I kept looking at that and going, why aren't these people getting some kind of a premium pay? They were denied this. And I talked to some of the gentlemen in Parks and Recs, and I said, what are they having you do during these lockdowns? Well, they had to keep the parks clean. They had to go in and clean the bathrooms. And they were telling me, yeah, we have to go in and clean, you know, the feces, the urine, the used syringes. And I thought, my gosh, this is, you want to talk about working with vulnerable situations.
Yeah, vulnerable and hazmat situation here, basically.
Yeah. So that's why during the past, let's say, 9 months, every time I would ask the board about it, I would say, why these people and why not the people in Parks and Recs? Now, remember, neither I nor probably Pima County knew about Chuck's retirement at the time.
Right.
So I noticed this disparity between selection, et cetera. And of course, if you will recall, absolute crickets, not one word. And, you know, at a call to the public, they cannot respond to you or ask questions, only in very rare circumstances. And it would just be like everything else. You stand up there, you speak at call to the public, you have 3 minutes, you've got to try and make it the most impactful that you can, get the facts in, and then it vaporizes.
So let's talk about the people who got, let's get out your binder here. And you mentioned that there are 11 people who got these bonuses. Now, one of the bonuses of for you as someone who's worked in the county is that you know a lot of the players that work at the county.
Yes.
So when you're seeing bonuses for certain individuals, right?
You can correlate that to a name.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. So let's talk. Let's go through the list, and we'll see. Let's talk about whether or not we think they're vulnerable. You know, vulnerable populations. How much? Let's start off. Who's number one on your list
there? Okay. Now this is directly from the public records request response from the county. And the first one they gave me was the chief admin assistant to the county administrator. Okay.
This is Monica?
I don't know of any other chief admin assistant.
Oh, so they wouldn't give you their name. Okay.
Well, no, I want to be fair to them. I did not ask for the names. Gotcha. And one of the reasons was...
I know they never give you more than you asked for.
You know, I think you have to ask the question. What role did these individuals have in deciding that they were getting a bonus? Right? I mean, you want to be fair to people.
So Chuck Huckleberry is chief administrative assistant got how much of a bonus?
$5,200.
Who's our next individual?
Our next one is...
Oh, I guess my other criteria is, do we think that person was exposed to vulnerable populations? I think the answer would be, let me say it in French, nah. Okay.
I'll let you answer
yeah,
those questions.
Absolutely. Let me say the troublesome stuff.
I'll give you the information. You can answer it. Okay. Communications and Graphic Services Director.
Okay. So comms director, which should be my boyfriend, Mark Evans, but we don't know about exactly. But what did possibly Big Mark get for a bonus?
$5,200.
Did Mark Evans work with vulnerable populations? The answer is probably not. That's Christy Simone saying that. What's your next one?
Finance Risk Management Director.
Finance Risk Management Director. Okay.
And there's only one director in each department.
Who do we think the director is in that department?
To the best of my knowledge, I know the Finance Management Director to be Michelle Campaign.
Okay. That's okay. Right. I remember that. Okay. Yep. And how much did that human being get?
$5,200.
This is like it's like Oprah, and you get $5,200, and you get $5,200, and you get $5,200.
Yeah, but now some of them coming up, all of a sudden they only get $2,500, and it's like you want to ask yourself, well, how come they didn't get $5,200?
All right, let's rapid fire through these ones who are, how much they only got? They only got how much?
So you've got three deputy directors in finance, of which if you go to the county website, you will see that there are three deputy directors in finance.
How much did those three folks get?
They each got $2,500.
Finance people are always working with COVID vulnerable populations.
Yeah.
That's called sarcasm. What's your next group here?
Admin Support Services Manager Unclassified. And that is in the Finance and Risk Management Department. That, you know, when they do admin support services, it could be, I actually know who this person is, but it could be somebody who's working, let's say, in payroll.
Gotcha.
Okay. And that person received $5,200.
Hold it. The admin support and risk management got $5,200.
Yes.
But the deputy director of finance only got $2,500.
Yeah.
What's your next one?
Deputy Director of Grants Management and Innovation, $5,200. Deputy Director of Grants Management and Innovation, $5,200. Now, what I find interesting here, I guess this is very innovative, okay? What I find interesting here is that the department, Grants Management and Innovation, is the department that is responsible for submitting, verifying, they ascertain as to whether an expense is allowable and allocable to the feds. So that's part of the role of Grants Management and Innovation. Before reimbursement to the feds goes out, it goes through Grants Management and Innovation. Okay?
Yes.
So both of them receive $5,200. Then we go to Human Resources Director, which this one is just... the piece de resistance, $5,200. Then we go to the deputy director in human resources, and that is $2,500. Now, these are directly from the public records request, And the information came from the Department of Finance and Risk Management response from Sam Correa, the Deputy Director of the Department of Finance and Risk Management.
Listener Kurt just said, let's see. And the timing of all these bonus payments was in the lead up to Chuck's retirement. Quid pro quo, Jerry. There it is.
Yeah.
The infamous Swap Shop theme song. And good morning and welcome back to the show, Charles Heller. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, and hop on board for value so that Swap Shop train will roll on, right on past you.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. Again, 24 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he says to me, I didn't want to correct you, but it's really 24 years. And I said, well, we're not doing the interview. I'm not waiting till the 25th anniversary. You
know, won't be the first time I've been thrown out of a radio station.
That's true.
Yeah, it is.
Sometimes it's harder than usual. Sometimes to throw Charles out of a
well, when Charles I don't lock the door.
And Charles is learning there is life on the other side of the glass.
It's so true. It's, I also now know what this room looks like with lights on. So, although I do have an occasional guest that I interview through the glass, they'll sit in that chair and
gotcha.
Where you are.
Sure. Again, Charles, he does Swap Shop, American Armed and Free, Liberty Watch.
And America's Fabric.
And America's Fabric. Mm-hmm. So, and you produce America's Fabric?
I produce them all, and I assemble America's Fabric, sometimes out of content from other places, sometimes out of articles I read with commentary for myself. It's about America's history and culture. It's on at 8:04 to 8:30.
So is this Sundays. The 24th anniversary of Swap Shop?
Yes.
Was this your first show with Swap Shop?
Swap Shop was my first show, right, yeah.
And so I guess we'll do a little bit of history and because there's a lot of new listeners over the years. Mm-hmm. I've heard Charles on the show, call the show, hear his shows on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
But what was Charles' first touch in the radio?
My first touch in the radio was I was doing the Swap Shop. I'd been a guest on several programs, on several stations. I'd been on a guest on 790 a couple times back in the day, back when it was KMGX even, and 624-2431 was the call-in number down at at the building that is no more downtown at El Presidio, to beautiful 177
La Placida.
La Placida, yeah. And that's where her studios were, where the famous Alopecia Lee took off her clothes in Pat Porter's studio. It was pretty funny. And, you know, down there. And then I wanted to do a Swap Shop program. The program had ended a few years ago before I started in 1999 on KNST. They couldn't sell radio. The two guys that did it, Mike and Mickey, and they couldn't sell their show. They could host it, but they couldn't sell it.
Sure.
And so they didn't know how to sell radio. And so I said to Pat Porter, who is the general manager, and he'd been the program director at KNST. He came over to 1330, which at the time was called KMRR. And I said, Pat, you got to put on a Swap Shop show. And he said, we're not going to do that. I said, no, Pat, you're the only station left in town that has the format that can do it. You need to do it. And he said, we're not doing that, Charles. I said, Pat, you need to do it. He says, get it through your head. We're not doing it. I said, get it through your head. I'm not leaving till you agree to. And he said, the only way we're going to do this is if you pay us an hourly fee and then you host the show. I said, how much? He told me. I stuck my hand across the table. You understand, there was no, this was a shell. It was a desk and there was no drywall.
So this is after you producing Bert Lee's
talk? No. Happened afterwards. I was already on the air when I started producing for Bert.
Gotcha.
But anyway, what happened with Pat was I stuck my hand across the desk and I said, deal.
How much was an hour of radio in those days?
$2.50.
Okay.
And I 6 weeks later, I started on the air, and there was still dust in the room from the construction, and I was shaking so badly that there was a tremolo in my voice from the shake of my knees, and there was a toilet paper rack for cleaning the screen that they had on top of one of the computer monitors. Randy Howard had built the studio, and so I took the whole roll off the rack and I put it between my knees to take the tremolo, the shake out of my voice. I'd had like three cans of Diet Coke and it still wasn't making the hoarseness in my voice go. I was so nervous. And we had 31 calls.
Wow.
I'd gone to everyone I know and said, are you my friend? They said, yes. I said, do you want to stay my... I said, do you want to stay my friend? They said, yes. I said, good. Then you're going to call on Saturday morning at 9:04 with something to sell. Well, what if I don't have anything? Find something. I took 31 calls. I've never had 31 calls in an hour since then.
So how long has this swap shop Tradio format been on the radio?
Since there was radio. I heard about this in 1970. I was in Interlochen, Michigan. My mom had a cabin up there, and she went to the National Music Camp there in Interlochen, and we'd spend a couple weeks a year up there, and I was listening to the radio, don't remember the station, out of Traverse City, and there was a fellow by the name of John DeRemus, whose voice sounded like his name, and he just had this most mellifluous voice, a word I learned from Paul Harvey, and he had a program called The Swap Shop, and people were calling in with the most interesting things. I was fascinated by it, and that's where I got the name for and the idea for this program. I knew before it ever came on the radio. When it started, I didn't have my own theme music. I was using Rodeo from Grand Canyon Suite, I think, and I had theme music. I had commercials produced. When I started, I had a sponsor.
Copeland, but not Grand Canyon Suite.
I'm sorry?
I think it's definitely Copeland Rodeo, but it's not from Grand Canyon Suite.
Thank you. I stand corrected. No, I want to be correct. I don't want to be right. And so, anyway.
But what's the rules of Swap Shop?
You can sell anything you want that's lawful and moral. Lawful means it doesn't violate the laws of man, and moral means it doesn't violate the laws of God. So if you want to sell your machine gun, as long as it's on a Form 4, and if you don't know what a Form 4 is, I'm hanging up on you. But as long as it's on a Form 4, fine. But no pornography. Because, you know, one has social value and the other doesn't. And I'm not here to preach to people, but I'm not going to help them do something that isn't healthy. You know, I could use a cup of coffee, couldn't you? I'm thinking maybe I could.
Oh, my Lord. I'm getting out-organized on my own show by these two jokers.
I'm thinking it's time for that cup of coffee, and I got my... And I want you to witness this. Look at this.
You got your 690 classic metal coffee cup.
690 what?
KVOI. Absolutely.
Yeah, before we changed frequencies to 1030. So this is an antique given to me by the great Doug Martin himself. And I sometimes like to flavor, get a little extra shot in my coffee. This is my actual tin full of my bag of white powder for the radio studio. It's actually creamer. And I like to shake it into the coffee and actually flavor it up. And so people know that I'm not joking when I say I bring this bag of white powder, and then I make sure I clean up all the dust so I don't leave white powder trails in a radio studio. That's bad karma. So you see, if you do
that. This isn't KLPX in the 80s. So.
Yeah, it gets Ray. It keeps Ray from yelling at you. And,
hey,
go ahead.
Are we allowed to go to break?
Well, I was going to stir the coffee first. I got my swizzle stick here, which is they don't want any they don't want any tools. Any sharp tools in here, so I just...
I don't want you running around with sharp tools.
Oh, well. So, there's my blue ink pen.
All right. We're on. Now, can we take calls for anyone who wants to sell anything?
Sure.
All right. If you want to sell or buy anything, 790-2040 right now.
And we have some wonderful music.
Who do we got here, Charles?
This is Star Trek Discovery.
Nacelles are in the right spot on this one?
Nacelles, yes.
Nacelles, thank you. You're on the Wake Up Tucson show, I think. Let me get this Wordle thing out. Matt, we see you and Van Buren. You're all geeking out on your Wordles.
Sure.
What's a Wordle? Let's go.
You guess a five-letter...
It's not a Pokemon creature.
No, you guess a five-letter word. And you get six guesses, I think, or seven, six guesses. And they tell you if you got the right letter, and then if it's... in the wrong place or in the right place, position-wise. So, and you get six guesses. Sort of like Mastermind with letters.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, this is from Robert Spencer. I call him Bobby.
Of course.
Or as we say in Hank Hill, Bobby.
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 Bobby. The boy ain't right.
Well, I'll tell you, that boy ain't right. Bobby.
So what was so offensive about Wordle? I missed this.
They posted an apology.
They apologized?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy. I saw there was one of these a few months ago, so I do know that sometimes people are, you know, set off.
Let's go over to the New York Times
piece
first. Let's do the apology first.
Rip the bandage off.
This is the apology was written by, this is an amazing name, Everdeen Mason, which I think sounds like a character from The Hunger Games. But Everdeen Mason, it's been just over 3 months. I feel like I should do it in my yacht rockets, the New York Times. 3 months since the New York Times acquired Wordle, the hugely popular puzzle created by Josh Wardle. Did you guys know that? It was created by Josh Wardle, so it's Wordle. Continues to delight millions of people every day. But as we move it over to the Times technology, we continue to discover challenges. Today, some users may see an outdated answer that seems to be closely connected to a major recent news event. This is entirely unintentional and coincidence. Today's original answer was loaded into Wordle last year. At New York Times Games, we take our role seriously as a place to entertain and escape, and we want Wordle to remain distinct from the news. Matt, guess what word it was?
Go ahead. I'm not even going to guess. So go ahead.
It rhymes with the word fetus. Cletus, I was going to say. It was the word fetus. So because the Wordle was fetus, New York Times people got triggered by the Wordle. The Wordle was fetus, and me and Fifi were quite triggered. It is a regular word in the English language.
It is a word in the English language, and the ones that offend me is if it's a word that has, or if you substitute one letter, you can have like seven different words, and I've got like five letters right on the third guess. And then by the sixth guess, I still haven't gotten it because I didn't guess the right one.
Wow. So anyway, you can't even put the word fetus in a puzzle without the New York Times people getting freaked out.
Wow.
Snowflakes, anyone? This K-Gun 9 headline of upcoming transit line to directly connect Tucson Mall and airport. So this is the Steve Farley mentioned this after the honk, right? That we should do more streetcars throughout Tucson. I love my Steve, but that was one of the things he wanted to, there he is, right? And that'll fix all of Tucson's problems. Instead of just focusing and prioritizing, we have to hit for home runs for federal funding, because that's the only way this stuff gets done. So, Matthew Neely, let me ask you a question. How much did it cost?
$50 million a mile. The new route is 15 miles.
Is it 15?
That's they're saying, okay. From the mall to the airport.
All right.
I think that's about 750 mil.
Let's see.
And that was $50 million a mile 10 years ago.
Let's go to
Before Google. The transitory inflation and everything.
Let's go to Google Maps. I don't trust these people on how long it's going to take. Let's see. And then we're going to go to Tucson Mall. There we go. It's probably right. Okay, 15 miles. We're good. I just want to make sure. All right. So we know, is it easy to say 75 mil a mile, 75 million a mile instead of 50?
Again, it's been 10 years. I'm sure the cost of labor's gone up because thank you, City of Tucson.
Oh, that's true.
You know, they raise the cost of labor and then they complain their streets are going to cost too much.
So this only works if somehow you get what you got now. Not actually, it's even got to be more. You have to have a really commanding lead of Democrats in both houses and a president. And then you're going to have to justify that, right? So I'm going to call it 80 mil a mile right now. I think I'm undershooting it. Okay. So what is that? That's a lot of money. Let's see, 80 million. So, $1.2 billion. So when Kagan9 puts a story out there that says upcoming, is it upcoming? It's so hilarious. Yeah, it's like upcoming whatever. Here we go, sorry. Yeah, upcoming transit line. And there's nothing in there about the dough. Now, the city has over $1 billion of pothole problems that they're not going to fix, even though they tell you they're going to fix it with Prop 411, which you're, if you're a Republican, remember, if you get that thing, it's sitting there next to your phone bill. You need to vote no and just mail it in on 411. That's a big fat no. Okay. So this is the Norte Sur thing that we did the polling on. So $1.2 billion, and I think I'm low on that. So you're going to have to find something in the future, right, that is in the federal government, and anything's possible in D.C. It's a crazy wonderland out there. But you're going to have to find some government bill to throw $1.2 billion at a streetcar in Tucson, Arizona.
Or a 1 cent sales tax, which I'm sure they'll say, well, everybody said they wanted it in this poll, so naturally you should vote for this other sales tax.
Very true. Let's go to a big streetcar fan, Bill number two. Bill, you're on that streetcar constantly downtown, right?
Honk, honk.
Oh, there he is.
Something like that. Hey, you've talked about this before, Chris. What would happen if they'd spend $1 billion or so on this thing to the from Tucson Airport to the mall or wherever they want to put the thing?
Yes.
What happens to the Tucson Airport if and when Marana builds a beautiful airport, easy access, get in, get out, on the interstate. You don't have to go through downtown Tucson or nothing unless you wanted to. Would you have this, you know, rail line going to nowhere, basically? Who's gonna ride from the airport to the mall when there's, you know, half the people are going to Marana flying in and out, if that happens?
So
what do you think?
You bring up two good points here, right? One is the idea that when Marana gets that thing going and I start getting some Southwest jets in there, TAA is in a world of hurt.
Okay. I agree, yeah.
Number two, because first of all, remember we always talk about we don't have a corporate base, enough big enough corporate base of travelers coming in and out of Tucson.
Well, they don't want one.
And I'm going to tell you something. You know, as Raytheon keeps bleeding more engineers, okay, there'll be less and less of that. When Raytheon one day says, you know, we're just going to have manufacturing and everything else is gone, then our corporate travel goes down to nothing. Okay? Yeah. This reminds me of when Rahina wanted to do high speed rail or some sort of rail between Tucson and Phoenix. Remember that whole thing? We're like, who's riding that? Who's going to get on the bus? Who's going to take the train up to Phoenix so they can get in a Uber and do 98 things in Phoenix? That's not going to happen.
Yeah, if you want something that really benefits Tucsonians, put in a cross town freeway. Boom. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, spend the money there. Do it. Put it over the top of Speedway and just let her rip. I remember they did that over Highway 1 in Hawaii from the naval base to downtown. This is way after I had left. But, it was just a shadow to ride on the old highway underneath it.
So someone asked me on Facebook about the crosstown freeway idea again. And it's the idea that it'll never, ever, 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 ever happen. Because think about all all the characters we've talked about where, you want to build a 24-hour coffee shop or something, right? And you go through the hell of these elected officials that are bizarre, weird, or ineffectual. Then you throw in the neighborhood associations, right? Then you throw in Carolyn Campbell and the conservation people, right? That just doesn't get done.
Well, these people like to think they're, you know, good socialists and communists, and the communists just do it.
Again, they got to go find the money, buddy. They still need money.
Well, if you're going to Washington, why don't you see if they've got a pothole fund up there instead of another tram thing? That's a good idea.
All right, my friend.
See you guys
later, amigo. Yacht Rock. We've had this discussion with Greg on the air before, right? So, Matt, how would you describe Yacht Rock to our friends out there?
Well, it kind of fits into the mellow rock genre.
So late 70s, early 80s?
Late 70s,
right?
Early 80s. Not quite as folky as what you would call mellow rock. So kind of soft rock, though. Yeah, I guess.
All right, here's something I was all reading right on the interweb. Yacht rock is characterized.
What's the definition? I can't define it, but I can tell you when I hear it.
Exactly. Characterized by glossy production.
There you go. Okay, I like it.
Breezy vocals.
Bingo.
And bouncy rhythms.
Yeah, okay.
All elements thought to evoke relaxing bay cruises in SoCal, where the genre originated. And I would say, again, no crunchy guitars. There's definitely a more synth-driven... with some horns.
Sure.
Okay. It feels like to me.
Yeah.
You're not going to hear any electric crunchy guitars on this. All right. So, and then again, on the XM, they have a yacht rock radio station. And again, the guy that they have doing the little liners in between, that guy, that was that voice I was doing yesterday. Yacht rock radio.
Little Thurston Howell-ish,
yeah,
you know, kind of a, I'm sure he drew heavily on Jim Backus, Thurston Howell on that one.
He's my muse today, Jim Backus. Who knew I was going to say that?
And the imagined yacht speak in Some Like It Hot, right? So, absolutely.
Spin us away with America. You can do some magic. Good morning, Matt Russell.
Spalding, get your foot off the boat.
If someone else has something else, liverish, because that's your piece and you're on the menu.
Yes, it is. Because yesterday was National Liver and Onions Day, and I'm still recovering.
Wow. Me too.
In a different way.
Yeah, who knew?
So you just, this is the piece is about your love of liver and onions.
Yeah, I mean.
And your historical journey through liver and onions?
Through liver and onions, right. And so something happened to me that I thought was really weird that gave me the idea for the story. So
you got hit on the head.
Nancy, and when I awoke, Nancy and I were having dinner at Ventana Golf and Racquet Club with a couple of other couples. So a table of six. Server comes over for our orders. I order the liver and onions. And as I watch...
Hold on.
Yes.
The Ventana Golf and Racquet Club is serving liver and onions?
Okay, you have to read the story.
Oh.
Because the story is about... It ends up being centered around Chef Issa Musa, who has said he knows better than not ever to take liver and onions off of his menu, and he tells why. But I order the liver and onions. As the server works her way around the table, three other previously unknown liver lovers... identify themselves and order the liver and onions as well. So here I am at a table of six. Four of us order the liver and onions. So I just scratched my head because I'm usually the only one. Like, I'm the anchovy guy and the fruitcake guy, you know, that everybody says you're gross. I'm usually the only one in the crowd. But four out of six of us. So I said, well, how is it possible that this dish that seemingly peaked in popularity back in the 70s when Steely Dan was on the air?
Correct.
How is it still relevant today? So I interviewed the chef, and he told, I thought, a fascinating story about why he is dedicated to offering that dish to his members. And he said to me, he's even worried, like legitimately worried from time to time that he's going to run out of it. And I thought, just imagine.
Supply chain.
Genuinely being up at night wondering if you're going to run out of liver and onions.
Lost in the supply chain.
So it's a fascinating story. And I have just been overwhelmed by the response from my, as I said, previously unknown fellow liver lovers who celebrate what an organ whose primary function is to process and excrete bile can actually do for a memorable culinary experience.
So again, as not a fan of the, you know, I'm a little awful put by it. That's a little bad pun right there. Tell me about how do you season something? It's just simple pepper and salt kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a traditionalist. So the classic way of doing liver and onions is, and Chef Musa is preserving that tradition. Slices of liver, dusted in some seasoned flour and some cornmeal, little olive oil on a flat top. You know, pan fry, served with sautéed onions, caramelized onions, and a couple of strips of bacon. So you got sweet, you got salt, you got in this wonderful full flavor of the liver. Now, people will do crazy, wild culinary things to it, which you don't need to overthink it. I mean, it's an internal organ, for crying out loud. Let the organ speak for itself.
Right.
But you said you're not a fan. Now, I would like to unpack that a little bit, because are you not a fan because you tried it and you hated it? Are you not a fan because you're eating an internal organ? Are you not a fan because nobody else is and you don't? I mean, yes, but you're okay. There it is. All three. You're okay with cutting into a cow's thoracic the chest
like Clarence,
cavity.
I'm like Clarence the Clown. I just conk when I answer now. I just do the dings.
I think what the liver crowd, the liver lobby needs to do is they need to rethink perhaps naming the dish, because ribs has become this great thing. I love ribs. You love ribs. We've had
right.
ribs together.
You judge ribs yourself.
I judge ribs. But when you think about what's happening, if you think about the grossness that a liver is, I mean, sawing into a chest cavity of a cow and pulling out, you know, this the thoracic inside. Ribs!
Should I be hitting the dump button here or what?
We need to come up with another name for this organ. This underappreciated organ that for years was a staple on the American
dinner
table.
So my mom's a big chopped chicken liver girl.
Yeah, well, different.
Chopped chicken liver salad. She
different
loves
animal.
It.
Different animal. Now, you know? Do you think that because it comes from a chicken and not from a cow, that chopped liver is more approachable and embraceable by today's
no, sir.
Foodies? No. I challenge you. And you can get old times.
You got to come up with a fancy name for liver.
Okay.
See, that's
what it is.
It's marketing.
Right.
This is a marketing problem.
And you and I are going
to
solve it.
Oh, there's the great Patty Ruiz. We'll have to ask her if she's
like
a liver.
She's going to have liver and onions today. So, Ventana, Jonathan's Cork has liver and onions on the menu all the time. Gus
wow.
Ballin's Old Times Cafe. So, read my article in Inside Tucson Business, and you will catch the buzz.
So I'm looking at a little article on this real quick, and so what we got to do is got to say the Italian word for it. That makes it better, I think, right?
Oh, this is an interesting approach.
So there's a Venice-style liver, so it's liver is fagatto.
See, we're already changing
right?
the narrative.
So fagatto alla veneziana.
Great.
Right? That sounds a lot better than liver and onions.
Right.
I mean, how boring can we get? Liver and onions.
Yeah, but
now I assume this started because in the old days, some of the best food out there comes from you got to use every part of the pig because
correct.
we're not that wealthy.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
All those good things, slow cooking and all that stuff. You use the whole damn thing.
Right.
I got it. I used to have grandparents that would serve the lamb's head on a, you know, on a plate at Easter time.
Right. But it was this wonderful manifestation when you have the scraps or the pieces of the animal that you normally wouldn't serve up, the fact that it actually tastes good. And I challenge you, you and I go out to liver and, out for liver and onions, one bite, and I think your whole attitude about it is going
to
change.
I am willing to go with you
okay.
and try again.
Okay.
Don't say Chris was ever close-minded when it came to eating more fagatto
in my
life.
You will be my guest at Ventana next time. Fagatto. Let's start that. I'm serious.
According to this, the traditional French way of doing it is butter and bacon.
Mm-hmm.
The Catalan in the Spain area there, I don't want to say they're part of Spain because then the revolutionaries will come after me, olive oil instead of butter, and then fried garlic.
Okay, yeah.
To the Spanish version.
Yep.
And then the fagatto alla veneziana is a dash of red wine vinegar, and then there's fagatto alla romana, which of course is Roman style, white wine, but then cooked in lard.
Okay, all perfectly acceptable.
So
I like the vinegar bringing a little bit of acid in to balance that the sweet and the salt. I think that's wonderful. I want it all.
In Brazil, the recipe calls for potatoes or other root vegetables to go with your liver.
All right.
Well, all right.
John Farlow just texted fellow wakey fellow foodie.
Yeah.
What's the liver word? Fagato?
Fagato.
Okay, fagato y cebollas.
Oh, okay.
I mean, there it is.
Right.
My mother tells a story about when
it's
I was
weird that it has the word cat in the word fagato.
Right. everything was working out just fine until you mentioned that. But so I've been eating liver and onions my whole life. And so my mom remembers a story when we went out. I was maybe 9 or 10 years old, and we went out for dinner, and the server came over, and I asked the server, do you have liver and onions? And my mom says the server looked at my mother with this profound look of concern and disgust, about ready to call CPS, because this poor child, you are telling him that he must eat liver and onions, but it was all on my own accord.
on a Yacht Rock Wednesday. Let's go back to Johnny and Binya from the New York Times. Gold, Jerry. This is gold, Binya. And these are two reporters from the New York Times talking about what happens in states where Democrats have all the power and there's no Republicans to block them, because that's always the blame, right? Is, you know, Republicans are going to ruin the law. We just heard the Schumer quote. So let's go to number one, and it's called Liberal Hypocrisies Fueling American Inequality is the name of the video. You can get it on YouTubes, right? But this is about housing, so let's go.
California. To me, California is like the quintessential liberal state. From the state legislature to the whole executive branch to most of the big cities, Dems hold majority control. So what do they do with all this power?
Looking at California, you have to look at housing.
Okay, now wait, listen. When I hear the words housing policy, I tend to sort of doze off. But Binya insists that housing policy and what is happening in California is definitely worth looking at.
You cannot say that you are against inequality in America unless you are willing to have affordable housing built in your neighborhood.
And Democrats completely agree here in this document. The word housing is mentioned over 100 times.
The neighborhood where you're born has a huge influence on the rest of your life. Children who are born in neighborhoods with degraded environmental conditions, with a lack of access to high-quality public services, poor schools, poor public transit, are at a permanent disadvantage.
And they even say verbatim, housing in America should be stable, accessible, safe, healthy, energy efficient, and above all, affordable.
Housing is a human right.
Housing is a human
California
right.
California politicians.
The rent is going through the roof.
Castro.
Housing is a human right.
How does California do when it comes to housing?
You know where those signs are when you drive into a state that says, welcome to California? They might as well replace them with signs that say, keep out. Because in California, the cost of housing is so high that for many people, it's simply unaffordable. The state has simply, for the most part, stopped building housing. I mean, there are cranes, there's housing going up, but it has slowed down over time really, really sharply, and it is nowhere near sufficient to keep pace with California's population. And so what you have is not enough housing and too many people trying to get it, and the inevitable result is that prices have gone up, up, and away.
The median price of a home in San Diego County is now a staggering $830,000.
All around California, there are cities full of people who say that they are progressive. They're liberals. They believe in a more equal America, a more diverse America. They show up to the marches. They put in the lawn signs about everyone being equal. But at the same time, they're actively fighting to keep their neighborhoods looking like this.
So a very pristine suburban neighborhood.
That doesn't look so bad. It's just a bunch of houses in a neighborhood, right? No. It turns out that this is actually the result of specific policies, intentional policies, that keeps these neighborhoods spread out and full of single-family homes, as opposed to higher-density buildings like duplexes or apartment complexes. This is a real serious fight, and you can get a glimpse into it by looking at a zoning map. Yes, we're looking at a municipal zoning map of Palo Alto, California. Don't leave yet. This is really where it sinks in, so just stick around. So everything on this map that is yellow is zoned for single-family homes.
It's about 60% of Palo Alto.
One family can live here. But here in Palo Alto, there are a lot of new jobs. This is a desirable place to live for new opportunities. Over the past 8 years, the San Francisco area has added 676,000 jobs, but only 176,000 housing units. So a few years ago, the city council voted to change the zoning of one section of the city right here. Specifically, this two-acre plot of land.
It's this little spot.
They wanted to change it from low-density housing to higher-density housing so that they could build a 60-unit affordable housing complex for elderly members of the community. Okay, so they changed the zoning. Start building the 60-unit complex. No. The overwhelmingly liberal residents of Palo Alto decided overturn the decision.
So this is the Not My Backyarders. Right. These are the neighborhood association people who say they're the feel good folks. So what they want to do is they want to take a 2-acre lot in the midst of this chunk of Palo Alto, 2 acres, and they want to do a 60 unit elderly affordable housing apartment complex. OK. And so this is This is similar to this other stuff you hear from the neighborhood associations in Tucson. Matthew, go ahead, please, sir.
Decision to revert it back to low density single family housing, back to yellow. And it passed, and the zoning was overturned. So now when you go to this plot of land, instead of an affordable housing complex for the elderly, what you're gonna see is this: a row of just a few houses, all of them massive and worth around $5 million each.
I think people aren't living their values. You go to these meetings in these neighborhoods where they're talking about a new housing project, and it's always the same
song. Here it comes.
And it goes like this. I am very in favor of affordable housing. We need more of it in this community. However, I have some concerns about this project.
We have the hearts to do this.
Here we go.
But we're doing it wrong, and we're dictating and harm onto the neighborhood.
Council person.
And then off we go with the concerns, and then nothing ever gets built.
This is happening all over California. And the result is that these neighborhoods are so expensive that they keep anyone out who isn't a part of this small group of super rich residents, many of whom bought their properties decades ago, and who spend their time fighting vigorously to keep the value of their real estate assets super high.
If you want to keep Palo Alto the kind of neighborhood community that we all treasure, low intensity, low density, safe for kids to walk to school, you've got to vote against Measure D.
There's an aspect of sort of greed here and of you know, nervousness about actually sharing those opportunities.
There
Let's
we go,
go
now,
another
taxation
liberal bastion up here in Washington State. The Democratic Party talks about taxation, saying that our tax code has been, quote, rigged against the American people. Democrats all the time are decrying the fact that tax cuts are going to the wealthiest Americans.
It is time for a wealth tax in America.
Liz Warren.
Democrats believe in a progressive tax system where the rich pay a larger share of their income than the poor. This is like the most basic policy vision of like a progressive movement. It's front and center in Democrats' policy platform.
But if you go and look at Washington State, what you find is that in Washington State, if you look at the state and local taxes that people pay there, less affluent families pay a much larger share of their income in taxes than the wealthiest residents of Washington State.
So people when you look at this thing, right, they have a bar graph, right? And they talk about in relation to percentage of income going to taxes, right? The top 1% is paying 3% in Washington, but the working poor is paying like 20%. But keep going.
Like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, two of the state's most famous and wealthy residents, are in this lovely situation of paying less in taxes as a share of their income than the poor people who live in that same
17.8%
state. And this is a fundamental inversion of the values that the Democratic Party professes. There is no state with a more regressive system of taxation than Washington State.
And I'm talking like the most regressive, meaning Texas, which is like the conservative bastion of like anti-taxes, is more progressive than Washington State, liberal Washington State. How is that real? Oh, and guess what? Other states on our map also are in the top 10 of most regressive tax regimes, like Nevada and Illinois.
There have been some changes, particularly in recent years, but the overall situation remains resistant to change.
So I'm very concerned that at this time, which is a very poor time to disincent people from creating jobs in Washington State, that we're even considering it.
From that paycheck that you earn, more of that money is going to state government. And so the effect of that is basically to exacerbate inequality.
Okay, so rich liberal.
Let's stop there because we're going to get to the bottom of the hour. So here's the best one. So regressive taxation, like Prop 411, exacerbates income inequality. How many times have you heard it out of Lane Santa Cruz, the mayor, any of these people's pie holes about income inequality? This is the beauty of it. I have the New York Times telling me that that attitude and that regressive sales tax leads to more income inequality, which is just amazing that Rahina, Lane Santa Cruz and these folks and the Southern Arizona Leadership Council and the Tucson Metro Chamber and Visit Tucson are shoving a regressive sales tax down poor people's throats. This is why you guys have a lot of issues. I got a lot of issues with you people. 2,000 mules. I got to see it in the last couple of days, and a bunch of you have asked me, have you seen it? Have you seen it? Have you seen it? I have. Now, to me, 2,000 Mules is a to get where we need to be on election integrity, this is a bite of a very big sandwich. This is the way I look at it. Right? So the basis of the if you haven't watched it yet, the mules thing, I'm not ruining anything for you. Is an organization, the True the Vote guys, and some company bought a bunch of cell phone data where they're tracking cell phones. And then using whatever supercomputers you're using, you can figure out, look for common phones that have been to common areas. And the common areas that they look at are ballot drop boxes, right? And nonprofit organizations that say they're there to help support voter participation. You know, like, I don't know if, I'm not saying this is a group, but like, you know, you see, we were just talking last week about Mi Familia Vota, right? And how they're asking you, they're going to help you get a COVID shot. That's their big, they're spending a lot of money on Facebook for that. And then Josh was at the Pima County Fair, Jacobson, and said, oh my God. And my take was on Facebook, I shared that and I said, oh, is Mi Familia Vota offering a COVID shot so they can voter register you? And that's what they were doing exactly at Pima County Fair. Mi Familia Vota. Now, so you have this, they're looking at the data, they're track, the mules are people who are getting paid according to the movie, and they're tracking their, again, the cell phone data. You know, it's not particular. They don't know exactly who it is. That you can't buy that. I'm sure you could, but you got to pay a lot more. And you're tracking them. They even have a part where you saw that a good portion of some of these mules were also running around various downtowns during Antifa riots as part of the movie. So you got that going. And then they're showing video of cameras on the ballot boxes saying that, and you're seeing people stuff somewhere between, I don't know, 10 and 30 or so ballots into the drop boxes. And of course, the drop boxes is the big problem. And so then you have that. That's a part of it. Then they have the interviews with a couple of people that have the distort over their face and the and, you know, and the backlighting, so you can't tell, and their distorted voice. One is a guy who was working for the National Republican Senatorial Committee, and he actually took pictures and videos of people stuffing ballots during the Georgia special election for the Senate. Said he gave it to the NRCSC. And they didn't do anything with it. Then you had actually the local flavor was a lady from San Luis, Arizona, just south of Yuma, and talking about how she was the one paying mules. And they would go into communities targeting, this is what she says in the movie, targeting seniors who don't speak English. And basically, you know, getting their, I don't know if they were paying them for the ballots. She also referred to her local party, local political machine down there as the mafia. And she said if she's afraid, that's why she didn't come on camera, if, you know, she thinks she would actually suffer bodily harm if they knew who she was. But the movie says she's, hopefully, I think she's dealing with actual, you know, the authorities. So anyway, so Yuma County, Arizona is actually in the Mules movie. So in the end, so why do I say it's a bite at the sandwich? Is because you have to take it to the next level, right? What is, you know, what do we do with this information? Right? The drop boxes are a huge, I mean, they're, if you can eliminate drop boxes, I'm a big fan of, you know, I'm a vote in person kind of guy, right? Remember Jimmy Carter did a whole thing, a commission on voter and election integrity in America 15, 20 years ago. And this is something in Europe that they say that one thing you should not have is mail-in voting. It is the most ripe for fraud and bad actions. Once you lose the chain of custody, it's over. So again, Republicans, while we were having Trump train with 48 cars driving down Oracle Road, the Democrats, all that money that came, remember all that money that came from Zuckerberg and his missus, right? That was to promote ease of voting because of during the Rona, and then we had all these ballot boxes. Actually, the lady from Yuma County says that they told everyone that you should be dumping ballots at night. There was also another part of it where they said dump it at night, and then there's certain ballot boxes to go to because they knew there wasn't a camera on the ballot box. So you got ballot dump boxes that with no cameras on it, and these people are just walking up at 2 in the morning and dumping in ballots. So if you're walking out of there saying this is incontrovertible proof, they're not there yet. All right, because it has to lead you down the line to, and they're getting there, but this is a bite of the sandwich. I'm glad he made the movie. Right? There's people going to say, "Oh, you know, I've already seen you just go look online, right? The fact checks from whatever newspaper out there." It's only about an hour flick. And it's a good first step, right? That you see. So what happens is someone has to verify how that, you know, I don't know who do you trust to do that? Right? You got to verify that data. Right, but just looking at these people shoving, this is the problem, right? You have, think about it. They have facial recognition software whenever you're walking around an airport or some of these areas. They should be facial recognitioning these people who are dumping boxes and start prosecuting, because you can't, they're doing it in states like Arizona where it's illegal to do such things. Good morning to Dr. Joanne DiFilippo. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Believe it or not, I only saw you 3 days ago.
Yes, amazing.
What's happened since our Monday discussion?
Well, okay, so let me, for maybe some of your listeners who didn't hear before.
Yeah.
Over the past year, actually I'll say the last 9 months, I've been asking the County Board of Supervisors, why did these individuals, and at the time I didn't know it was 11, I knew it was a number, but I didn't know it was 11. Why did these individuals get these COVID incentive bonuses? Because they're pretty high-ranking individuals.
Yep.
Pretty much all directors or deputy directors located within county admin. And they either receive $5,200 or $2,500. And I found it just really strange because I knew there were workers in the county. I'm going to call them, for the most part, the non-salaried classified individuals making $35,000, $45,000, $50,000 a year who actually had to do a lot of work in the community, and they were called essential workers. They could not telecommute. So I filed this public records request, and I asked for three things. One, I wanted to know what employees from county admin, human resources, and finance received COVID incentive bonus pays with the pay period ending April 24th, 2021, and I believe I extended it to July 3rd. I figured there were five periods, but I made it six just to see if there was a little carryover. I suspected these payments might go until the end of the fiscal year, which is June 30th. The second thing I asked for is, what was the criteria that was used to award these? You know, what was the basis for this? You've got to have a basis.
Right.
And there should be something in writing, because it has to trigger from whoever issued the directive to at least payroll. And payroll is a part of finance and risk management, because otherwise you cannot effectuate the payroll system to award the bonuses, right? So there had to be some kind of communication there. And the third thing that I asked for was, who approved these bonuses? Now, the response that they gave me in the number three, who approved, that was Chuck Huckleberry. Well, that's okay. We knew that. Okay. But the interesting thing is number two. When I asked, what was the criteria? The response that I received from the county was, finance and risk management has no responsive documents. Well, that's not what I asked you. I asked you what the criteria was. What has occurred since I last came here on Monday's show.
Which is?
Which is, Interestingly enough, a memo from Jan Lesher to the County Board of Supervisors dated May 10th states, the board has been asked questions about the COVID premium pay provided to some employees in central administration. Attached, please find the memorandum recommending such pay for 19 employees, not 11.
Oh.
Remember, the county responded to my public records request stating there were 11 employees. It has now increased to 19. There's a reason for that. And it says it was approved in April 2021. Okay. And attached to it is a memo. Whether it's an alleged memo or a memo, I don't know. The county will have to answer for that, okay?
Yeah.
It's dated April 7th, 2021, and it goes from Jan Lesher to Chuck Huckleberry. It's two pages. And Jan's laying out why they believe that premium pay should be awarded to these individuals because they were, quote, needed to maintain continuity of operations of essential critical infrastructure, unquote. And that the county's response to the pandemic would not be possible if the health department were not supported by individuals within central administration services and the county administrator's office. And then on page two, Ms. Lesher lists the 19 employees, their name, which I'm not going to, their names are not the issue, okay? It lists their home department. Well, we know from the prior copy that they gave me, we know what their home department and their job titles are, as well as what they were paid. And what Lesher asked for is that she recommends that these individuals are paid in accordance with the table providing for a period of 10 weeks effective during these five-week pay periods. And I look at this, and on page two, there's two lines, approved, disapproved. Approved line item is checked, and under that, the signature of Chuck Huckleberry dated 4/7/21. So what I found interesting is this April 7th, 2021 memo is exactly what lays out the criteria for why these premium pays were awarded. Now, that's exactly what I asked for in my public records request, but this document was not produced. Instead, what I received was a response that said, Finance and Risk Management has no responsive documents.
So they told you that this document doesn't exist, or that department doesn't have it.
Yeah.
Right?
Basically.
But at the same time, now this pops up.
And it pops up within 36 hours after I come on your show.
Correct. Now, the other thing is, so the criteria is laid out in this April 7th of 2021 memo, but Chuck signs off on their approvals on April 27th of 2021.
Well, Chuck actually signed off on the approval on the same day.
That's what I'm saying.
April 7th, 2021. Yeah.
That's the part that's a little weird for me.
Yes, yes. There is a direct correlation between this memo, the criteria, and Chuck approving. You know, somebody might want to turn around and say, oh, well, that was Jan's memo, not Chuck's memo. Sorry. I asked of the county at large what was the criteria. If this memo truly did exist at that time, then this memo should have been produced as part of the public records.
But so there's two things here. Either they screwed you on your FOIA or they created a new document. That's the only way logic would go here.
The way you would check this out is you would go to the actual document, most likely drafted in Word. You click right on the mouse, and you look at the document properties to see when it was created.
Right.
Those are historical tracking records. Okay? Now, interestingly enough, I did right-click on this PDF. Okay? And it says that this document was created at 8:52 in the morning on May 10th, and it was modified. May 10th, 2022. Okay? And it was modified at 8:58, 6 minutes later. Now, it could very well be that it was the May 10th cover letter memo.
Right,
okay?
Right. That's
so
true.
We give them the benefit of the doubt on that. But to add insult to injury on this, there are 19 people here. Now, four of these individuals I didn't ask for because I didn't even know they had been awarded bonuses. And it's three people from the IT department, who each received $5,200, as well as the director of analytics, data, and governance.
What?
Who received $5,200. What I found really interesting was the tech department ones, because I knew that those tech department people had worked with employees from the library One of the tasks that they all did was to establish the phone bank. For remember when people could call in and like schedule help with vaccines getting registered and in the system, et cetera?
Right.
Well, I do know, and I checked it out this week because I was kind of curious. On the Pima County website is an annual report from the library. And noted within that annual report, which anybody can click on and see, you'll notice that they answered 42,000 calls from the community over a 6 to 8 week period. Yet none of those library people were given any kind of premium pay.
That didn't help with the continuity of our COVID response?
Absolutely.
We're hanging out with John Brakey. What's the website for audit?
It is auditelectionsusa.org.
Auditelectionsusa.org.
Yeah. I don't like the system in Arizona when it comes to recounts. You know, to get a recount in the state of Arizona, if you're running for a state race or something like that, is 0.1%. And that's not very much. In the county level, it's 10 votes. And Maricopa, on election night, had candidates running against the Board of Supervisors. And I want you to know, on election night, it looked like that the county was going to be run by three people of color.
So what you're saying is...
a black man and a black woman.
Do you think that the... what you're saying is that the Maricopa Board of Supervisors' reluctance to work with Karen Fan might have something more to do with their own elections than caring about Biden-Trump?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and nobody's ever looked into it, and I keep talking about it.
So when you look at the Arizona elections and Maricopa County, maybe even Pima County, what went wrong? Did anything go wrong?
You know, things could always work a lot better. Elections are complicated. This was the biggest election in 120 years with percentage of turnout, okay? But... because the procedures and the way they do things, people can get very confused. Example, did you know that in Maricopa, they have a voter database of 2.6 million people? No, they don't. They have a database close to 3 million because they have 267,000 people on an inactive list. Pima had 50,000, okay? How do you get on an inactive list? You haven't voted in two federal elections in a row, or they sent you two documents and you, like a vote by mail, and you never filled it out. Well, they put you on the inactive list. If you walk into a voting center in Maricopa County and you put your ID below this cursor, the computer system is going to recognize you, and now you're an active voter. That creates precincts that have super high turnouts. And a lot of Republicans don't believe 100% turnouts, and I don't either.
Right.
But if you have, when you put a result out saying that your county had a, look at this, an 80.1% turnout, when the reality is 10% of your voters are on an inactive list, you're kind of putting out information. You're trying to look good. I'm not saying they did anything really wrong, but we want to see a system set up. And that's what we're working for, me and Ken Bennett, with this House bill, is that we want to make Arizona's elections transparent, trackable, publicly verified, using ballot images that you could download. And then when you add them up yourself or your precinct, you should be able to go to a ballot library, which is just normal storage.
Right.
But we want them to put the inkjet back into the high-speed counters and physically marry the ballot once it's anonymous, okay, and cannot be tied back to a voter. And then marry that to the image. You get the images. Everybody else can add up their own and verify. Because right now in this country, it's a very dangerous country, okay? 50 million Americans think that Trump's election was stolen, okay? 64% of us, including me, think our democracy is in crisis. And it really is. We're more close to having... we're such a divide in this country that a guy like me, who is a hard... core progressive Democrat, okay,
right,
couldn't get one Democrat in the House, even though I kind of jumped in late, to support a bill that 31 Republicans support.
Hold that thought for a second. Matt, you were going to say something.
Just a quick follow-up question on the discussion about the Maricopa County Supervisors' reluctance and pushback on this. Were any of those three races you cited
anywhere near close?
Oh, absolutely. One at the final analysis, one of the race, well, of course, the Hispanic guy, I forget his name offhand, he won. He's been in there for a long time. The one person got within 0.1%. But because it was a 10-vote margin, he couldn't challenge. The other person, I think, fell out by 0.4. And I want you to know that Fontes lost his race by 0.23%. And he was very much disliked by Republicans.
Sure.
You know, I'm a friend of his. And I'm a friend of Ron Fincham, too. And I'm proud to say that both of these men who are running for office are supporting this bill to make elections transparent, trackable.
Let's go right to this clip from Bill's show yesterday. The not too impressive or inspirational Rex Scott was on yesterday. And listener Mike, he emailed me yesterday, said, hey, I called up Rex on the show, and this is the answer he gave. Am I missing something? So let's go right to the question. Here we go.
Go to the live line. Mike has called us. Listener Mike would like to speak with our interviewee, Rex Scott. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about the COVID bonuses that were paid to administrative personnel at the county. For instance, the communications director and other administrative staff receiving so 5,000 bonuses. Are you okay with that? With the use of taxpayer money in that manner?
Here comes the smugness.
Well, those bonuses, Mike, we got a memorandum from the county administrator explaining to us who was eligible for those bonuses. Those were paid out before the current board took office. But we did get...
All right, stop right there. He just said those bonuses were paid out before the current board took office. Did I hear that right, Matt? I just want to make sure.
That is exactly what County Supervisor Rex Scott said.
All right. So, Matt, Rex, what's it going to be? We got the choices here. All right? This is like picking the, you know, which one of the Grail chalices at the end of the Last Crusade. But here you go. Either you're totally erroneous, or you're a liar. So just pick one, Rex. I assume you're going to come out with erroneous. But how calmly smug you answered Mike's question was beautiful.
He also did not answer the question. He answered the timing, but he did not say whether he thought that was
he
a good idea.
He says later how he was satisfied with whatever was in the memos, I think is what he said. We can go. Okay, let's go.
Explanatory memorandum that was sent to the previous Board of Supervisors.
Previous Board of Supervisors.
Which employees were eligible for those bonuses and why they were granted to them. And for all of those people who worked in a variety of departments, the reason they did so is because of their work in the beginning of the pandemic, back in the spring of 2020. And so I felt like the previous board got a fulsome explanation as to why those bonuses were given to the employees in question, and I appreciated that this board got to see a copy of that memorandum as well.
So just to let you know, this is from the FOIA request that Joanne got, and she already said this twice this week. That's the best part. Mike, listener Mike knew better. Okay. So they were paid April 24th of 2021 through July 3rd of 2021. I think it's so hilarious. The COVID bonus payments to these people started on April 24th and ended on the pay period right before Chuck did his horse crap retirement thing. I'm sure it's all coincidence. All coincidence, right? So, we had, remember, county administration, communications, five people in risk management, finance, in the finance department got bonuses. All right. Grant management and innovation, I'll start attaching names to this before it's over. And the human resources director. It's so funny, the people who got their pay, their bonuses. So Rex, you just tell us, were you erroneous or did you lie to Mike? I'm sure you were erroneous. I don't know if you were trying to bullcrap poor Mike. I don't trust you as far as I can throw a bus, but let's say you're erroneous. I'm sure you're erroneous.